Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have really looked forward to speaking with. He was actually referred to me by my good friend, Lynn Alden. So anyone that Lynn refers, you know, is going to be top shelf and incredibly intelligent. So if you'd all join me in welcoming to the Rebel Capitalist Show, Macro Alf, or at Macro Alf, and it's Alfonso Pacatiello. Or am I really butchering it?
That's one of the best efforts I've ever heard so far, George. My pleasure to be here. And I hope I won't disappoint Lynn with my performance on the show. Let's give it a try.
Yeah, okay. So could you give my viewers and listeners a little bit of your backstory?
Yeah, sure. So I used to be on the other side of the boat, on the dark side of the equation, managing a $20 billion portfolio for a large bank.
Okay. Yeah. So, I won't hold that against you.
yes, absolutely. Please do. But now I'm not on the dark side anymore. I actually moved to the bright side, which is effectively putting out my knowledge and my my macro thoughts for you guys. I do that mostly on my newsletter. It's free. It's a Substack newsletter. It's called The Macro Compass. You can just find articles there. It's mostly financial education, macro insights, but also actionable investment ideas to make this actually work for everybody. So that's what I do now. No dark side anymore, no institutional, no large portfolio management, just putting out my thoughts out there.
Okay, great. So I'd like to dive right into, I mean, there's so much to talk about right now, and we haven't spoke before, but I'd like to kind of get your framework and maybe the two or three things that you are thinking about the most right now. For me, it's the flattening of the yield curve and the potential inversion. And actually this weekend, I was trying to think through and research to the best of my ability how much of an impact the Fed actually has on the long end of the curve. You know, I'm good buddies with Snyder, with Jeff Snyder. And he and Emil were this weekend were talking about a study that came out by the Fed. I can't remember which Fed person was talking about it. The gal last name George. I can't remember her last name or her first name. But her last name was George. I remember that, of course. But they're saying that, that even with all the quantitative easing with 1, 2, and 3, it didn't have that much of an impact on the long end. And even according to the Fed, maybe 15 basis points to 150 basis points. So, you know, number one, that would lead me to the conclusion that there's probably the bond market isn't sniffing out a lot of long-term secular inflation right now, even if the Fed is making an impact. But then I try to think through, even if they're making that 15 basis point impact, how would that affect the predictive ability of the inversion of the curve or even the flattening? Do you have any ideas there?
Yeah, well, I used to manage a portfolio mostly in fixed income. So I'm effectively a professional bond investor.
Great.
And I'm very vocal about the importance of the yield curve. So the first message I want to send out is that central banks cannot really influence the long-term bond yields. They can try to slightly move them up or down temporarily, but the long-term drivers of these long-term bond yields are something else, George. Yeah. And this something else is population growth, or to be precise, labor supply growth. So how many people are working in the economy and how productive is this labor force and the capital that we use throughout our economy. So long-term bond yields, basically they reflect long-term growth and long-term inflation expectations, right?
Isn't that Irving Fisher?
Yeah.
One is his basically hypothesis, 100 years ago?
Yeah, correct. And it's never changed. It's never changed. We always get impressed by the media coming at us and telling us, oh, it's QE, it's QT, long-end yields are going up or going down. If you plot 30-year treasuries or 10-year treasury yields, a chart, 40 years old, 50 years old chart, you see one declining trend down in yields, long-term yields, and then you see some cycles around this. Those cycles are generally short-lived. The trend is very clear. It's coming down. And if you do this in real interest rates, it's even sharper. It's even more clear. And why is that? Because apart from the period between 1950 and 2010, where population growth post the Second World War, with, you know, with this new welfare and this new attitude that we had towards liberty, towards rebuilding the economy, apart from the 67 years period where population growth was about 1% a year on a global basis. If you leave aside this period, in all the history of humanity and going forward, according to United Nations, the population grows by 0.5% a year or less. So basically, humanity grows by a tiny bit per year. The problem is that this humanity is becoming older as well. The population is aging, George. So even if it grows a tiny bit, the aging of this population doesn't make the labor force grow. Even if it grows a little bit, there are a lot of more people that are inactive in the economy and less people that are actively contributing to real growth over the long term. If you look at the US or Europe, Europe is even worse. In Europe, population, the labor force growth is going to shrink year after year after year from 2020 to 2050, 2070. How are you supposed to generate long-term structural growth if you have less and less people working every year and more people who are inactive, George? Yeah. And so if you buy a 30-year bond, you're buying the growth that is going to come up over the next 30 years and inflation expectation as well over the next 30 years. So you have these strong trends of technology, you have demographics, you have the world is more and more indebted. We are drowning under debt. And so to service this debt, these rates also need to be lower and lower. And you see this trend coming in. And so the Federal Reserve can come in or the ECB and they can do a bit of QE to stimulate now or QT and then they reduce some stimulation today. They become less commodity. But over the long term, 30-year bond yields are very little impacted by that and are much more impacted by demographics, productivity, technology, debt. And all of these factors are here to stay and they've gotten worse actually after the pandemic.
Yeah, so I think the pushback there just initially would be people saying, well, they're going to quote unquote print so much money that it's going to overwhelm the technological advances or the lack of productivity, the demographics. So are you, you know, is your view consistent with maybe Lynn or Jeff in the sense that you're saying, okay, what the Fed's doing by expanding its balance sheet or maybe even the ECB, that's not really money printing because for that money to, you know, I just call them bank reserves denominated in dollars just to differentiate Correct. Between the cash in the real economy and the cash in the Fed's balance sheet, the banks still have to lend to create dollars that are circulating in the real economy or you get massive deficit spending by the government that's monetized by the Fed, but assuming the politicians are kind of kneecapped by the CPI right now, if you will, you know, then it falls back on the shoulders of the commercial banks. And if they are seeing the exact same thing you just said, well, wait a minute, we got demographic decline, we've got productivity going down, let's say because of government regulations, and we've got you know, these technological advances, we are seeing an economy that we don't want to lend into. Or productive means, let's say, and we'd rather take that balance sheet capacity and create loans for the financial economy, as an example. And so, is that kind of your view there? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm just trying to explain how people would push back, and then how others that I talk to that are extremely intelligent would kind of push back on them.
So instead of answering this question, I actually want to make this C.
Can oh, there you go. Yeah, I didn't see that before. There you go. Yeah, we should buy one of those and send it to Emil and Snyder.
Here you go, guys. Here you go. Central banks do not print money. Sorry, it's cold, so I'm going to put it on again. So yeah. You're talking to the right guy when it comes to that. I'm also very vocal on the macro compass, George, on the fact that, wow, we get so much crap from mainstream financial commentators.
Yeah, right.
Every time talking about, you know, QE money printing, QT money destruction. Now, there are two tiers of money in the economy. They're very separate. One is bank reserves and the other one is spendable money. Mm. So bank reserves are not spendable. I mean, they're just interbank financial money and banks just use them to settle against each other. If a bank, let's say you're banking with JP Morgan, I'm banking with the Bank of America. And then we make a gazillion transactions during the day, George. And then at the end of the day, Bank of America and JP Morgan need to settle these payments against each other. They are on our back settling the payments. They'll do it with bank reserves. Well, that's really it at the end of the day. Plus, they serve some regulatory liquidity thing, some boring stuff that has nothing to do with the spendable forms of money. The spendable forms of money are different. Those are, in our economy, 97% bank deposits. Now, not all bank deposits are the same. Some of those can't be spent. So if you stock a pension fund with a bank deposit, then yeah, the pension fund also can't do anything inflationary with this bank deposit. But to make it simple, bank deposits are the closest proxy to spendable forms of money, electronic spendable forms of money that are in our economy. And do you know who produces new bank deposits? As you said before, governments, when they print deficits, what they literally do is they basically spend, move to the private sector more resources than what they intend to tax the private sector from. So they're like, you know, we're expanding the balance sheet and we're throwing these checks to George Inbox. Now George Inbox all of a sudden, yeah, stimulus checks, right? And so they have, this is one way to do it. And now you have more bank deposits. You can literally spend these bank deposits if you want. The other is commercial bank lending, as you said before. So the idea that banks lend existing deposits or they use reserves to lend has been empirically proven wrong. And actually the prevailing theory 100 years ago was the correct one, that banks create new deposits when they lend. They expand the balance sheet. Now, these guys are the ones that produce spendable forms of money, not the central banks. Central banks do something different. They create more reserves for the interbank system to have more interbank liquidity, to be more confident they can settle, and they also serve other regulatory requirements. That's a completely different game, and we can talk about why do they do QE in the first place if it's not to throw resources at the private sector, that ultimately it's the government and the commercial banks that decide if they want to lend, if they want to print more money for the private sector to use or not.
You know, the way I say that, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is I usually try to say, if you want to look at quote unquote money printing, you've got to look at the dollars on the balance sheets of non-bank entities in the real economy.
Yes.
Do you think that's a good way to say it?
It's a good way to say it. I would focus on non-financial entities. Mm-hmm. So if you look at bank deposits of an asset manager of a pension fund, when QE happens, the Federal Reserve buys bonds from dealers, but these dealers need to have these bonds from somebody else first, right? They need to buy it from a bank or a pension fund or a asset manager, then to recycle it back to the Federal Reserve. So what the Federal Reserve does ultimately, forget about the dealer for a second, is it takes bonds from the private sector away and it swaps them with either bank reserves or what I call inert bank deposits. If it's a bank, that's easy because a bank sells the bond through the dealer to the Federal Reserve. In exchange, they get bank reserves.
Yeah, so
their balance sheet, it's an asset. So the balance sheet hasn't gone up, hasn't expanded, it's just changed its composition.
Right.
The same if the Federal Reserve would buy the bond, always through the dealer, but forget the dealer, would buy the bond from a pension fund. The pension fund will now have less bonds and more bank deposits. Pension fund cannot have bank reserves. They do not have access to the Fed directly. They will have more bank deposits. And the pension fund can't do much inflationary with these bank deposits, George. Right. I mean, they can just run some interbank risk and deposit it at JP Morgan, do some reverse repo, but it's all financialized forms of cash. It's not that they can go and buy bread with it, right? To make it very simple. So I tend to look at the best way I found to look at this is a metric I've built. It's called credit impulse. Mm-hmm. So it looks at the non-financial side of the economy, and it looks at how much credit is being thrown at these entities,
right,
on an aggregate basis, and it measures the pace of this credit creation. It's not like we always grow credit over time. We become more indebted. We use leverage. We do it continuously. From the 80s, it has always gone up. So it's not the trend. The trend will remain up in terms of credit, but it's how fast you're sloshing these non-financial private entities with newly created spendable forms of money. And so, as you said, these spendable forms of money ends as in dollar bank deposits from non-financial corporates. If those are going up very quick, very fast, like it happened in 2020, early 2021, because the governments went ballistic with fiscal deficits,
right,
and banks were sponsored by governments to lend on top of it, if those spendable bank deposits to non-financial private entities go up very, very quick, yeah, then that's a recipe to have some inflation. And here you are, here you have it. The opposite happens when you turn this down. You're just basically removing all this credit. Not even on a net-net basis, it's important that you just slow it down. If you slow down the credit creation, the impulse of spending, potential spending from the private sector also dwindles down. Right. So it all has to do with the pace of injection of credit.
Yeah, you know, another thing I try to do to really understand it is I try to compartmentalize velocity. Mm-hmm. Because you know what you're talking about when you're looking. So a pension fund might be a non-bank entity.
Yeah.
But that those dollars on their balance sheet, to your point, they're not out buying Big Macs and cars and whatnot. So that those dollars are going to move at very slow velocity, where if you've got the same $1 billion, let's say, that's on the balance sheet of the average Joe and Jane, then most likely those dollars are going to move very, very quickly, and therefore cause that not just increase in aggregate demand, but increase in velocity, which would, you know, all things being equal on the supply side, which would increase prices.
Yeah, so actually the bank deposits on pension funds or asset managers, those are almost by definition zero velocity bank deposits. I mean, GDP-wise or aggregate demand-wise, directly, they can't do much. The velocity of newly created bank deposits on my bank account or on your bank account, George, those might be inflationary and push up aggregate demand. And I say might because the other problem we have is the two ways we described, bank lending and government deficits, the two ways to create new spendable forms of money, are quite different amongst each other. Because in order for a bank to lend, George, there must be somebody willing to borrow.
Right.
You need to show up at the bank and you need to say, I want a loan as a corporate or as an individual, which means that you have something in mind, right? You have a project, you have an outlet of productive investments you maybe have in mind to recycle this newly created credit. And, you know, so it takes you to show up to the bank, go there and ask.
Creditworthy.
And you need to be creditworthy, you need to have enough capital to attach, and they need to get a risk reward out of lending, which makes sense. But it still requires you to show up at the bank as a borrower. So you have something in mind with it. When the government takes out the credit creation, well, they can literally decide to cut your taxes, George, straight away, for example, or send you stimulus checks. Maybe you don't want them. Maybe you don't know what to do with it. Maybe you have no idea. And so that form of credit creation is much more coming from the top rather than from the bottom. And so in Japan, the typical example I always make is Japan. So in the 80s, they created so much credit, it was all over the place. Japanese banks were lending, the government was making fiscal deficits at the same time. And so you had this Japanese Nikkei real estate bubble. It all went through the roof until the Bank of Japan said, you know what, I think we should raise real interest rates here. And so obviously, if you increase leverage, it looks very cheap if you can finance it at very low real interest rates. Once you put them up and the refinancing becomes more expensive, then the whole castle of cards drops. At the second iteration, what they did is, okay, so Japanese banks were in a consolidation basis. We had the first mega banks creation. They, you know, they were struggling to lend. They didn't want to expand their balance sheet. So the government thought, I don't want to see all this deleveraging going on. I'm going to try to do more fiscal deficits. So that's Japan in the 90s and in 2000. Do you know what the private sector did? The private sector took all this newly created money from the government and used it to pay down their existing debt.
Right, which decreases the amount of money.
Exactly. So they just made it a wash. And that's why Japan can't really or couldn't really push up cyclically their economy that much and their inflation perspective that much, because the private sector simply refused to lever up more after the experience they had in the late 80s. And that tells you something about the government sloshing credit into the system against the private sector saying, I want to borrow because I think there is a way I can use this leverage in a more productive way.
Yeah, Lynn always points out that Japanese M2 money's M2 growth has been the lowest, I think, of all the developed economies. since at least for the last 10 years or so. You know, and she always uses that as an explanation as to why they haven't had or have struggled to try to create that type of inflation, price inflation.
Watch out with M2, George. It's a measure that I think amongst the monetary aggregates is the best.
Yeah, I know. It's a bad. But, I know. I just use that kind of as a proxy for. I shouldn't say that, but I'm just using that because everyone knows M2. So they know that I'm talking about money supply growth, but I shouldn't use that. I know that's kind of lazy thinking on my end.
No. It's not about that. It's I think it's the closest, most understandable proxy, right? Yeah. But it also includes inert zero velocity bank deposits by definition, as we discussed before. So I created my own metric, which is credit. I call it credit, like real economy credit, to make me understand really how much spendable money are we creating, at which pace are we creating that. The other point I want to make, George, is there is no magic wand. It's not like if we create spendable forms of credit at a super fast pace and we keep on doing it year after year, then we have the recipe for incredibly strong nominal growth for the next 30 years. So you are just overlaying cyclical growth by the means of leverage, by the means of creating temporarily new credit, you're just overlaying temporarily cyclical growth. On top of the structural factors, you remember those we discussed in the past, those are really the backbone of your ability as the private sector to generate cash flows over the long term. That's demographics, that's productivity, that's technology. Those are the structural trends.
Right.
If you create more credit, you temporarily overlay more spending capacity on that. But you're also becoming more leveraged, more and more and more and more leveraged as the sum of private sector debt and public sector debt. So then the problem is, how do you sustain this leverage? So what are the returns in GDP terms that you generate from this increasing leverage? And Dr. Lacey Hunt has one good study on that that shows that the marginal productivity of every dollar of debt created has been going down over time.
It's a negative multiplier over a certain debt GDP, isn't it?
Yes, because we find less and less productive ways to generate, basically to use this newly created credit. And at some point, we just create new credit to kick the can down the road because we want to grow at cyclical growth levels that are acceptable, socially and politically acceptable. So we lever up, we make the cost of credit less and less expensive. I mean, real interest rates at some point, if you took a mortgage last year, 30-year mortgage in America, you paid about, I think, 3% for 30 years. Now, if you expect inflation to hover around 2% over the very long term, let's say it hovers around 2% CPI-wise, you are paying a meager 1% real interest rate cost for 30 years to lever up. Well, this is very cheap, especially if your real wages will increase even a tiny bit year after year. So it's really little, but you're getting this credit to do what? To buy a house. So this house will become today more and more expensive and give the previous owner a wealth illusion effect. He will feel more wealthy because you, George, can borrow cheaper to buy the very same asset that he borrowed more expensive for 30 years ago. So then we start to make this game of extending credit, not for productive purposes, but just to keep the wealth illusion effect up.
Yeah, the asset prices. Do you think there's an argument there? Because let's go back to aggregate demand.
Yeah. Or
what I say in my whiteboards, just kind of focus on purchasing power. Do you think there's an argument for someone saying, okay, Alf, I get what you're saying, but if the pension funds, if the financial institutions are taking this extra balance sheet capacity from quantitative easing, and that's making the stock market rise or the housing market, you know, to your point, if mortgage rates are at 3%, it makes it much more affordable. You're going to see people increase their equity. And if their equity doubles, let's say in 2 years, because of this financialization, or their 401k goes from $200,000 to $1 million, can't they cash out into real dollars that circulate? And then that creates additional purchasing power, additional aggregate demand without those banks or the government kind of intervening or doing so in an indirect way.
So capital gains are an indirect form of money printing. That's what you're saying ultimately, yeah, right? Because when you cash in from this new from this capital gains, this fictitious paper capital gains, the moment you cash in, your net worth has basically increased all of a sudden, right? Now, that is true. The point is that it's not a steady state where the economy stops there. So politicians want to keep the status quo. When I was managing this large portfolio, I had the chance to speak to a lot of these policymakers, central bankers, I'm talking about G10 prime ministers even. So I, with a G10 prime minister, I can't name him, but we had a discussion. And so I told him, look, why are you not implementing reforms that will enhance long-term growth, long-term structural growth? And the guy just looked at me like, I'm not going to get reelected if I do those. I mean, those might work, but the guy who's going to reap the benefits out of it comes 20 years from now. It's not me. So the incentive scheme is basically to keep the status quo there and to keep the ball rolling without being on the tails of the distribution, like no major events that are on the tails. So for the people to be able to cash in the capital gains, basically, George, on a continuous basis, controlled and continuous basis, what the policymakers are doing in a fully credit-based system is to make sure that credit expands year after year and we become more and more leveraged, but also the cost of this credit needs to be cheaper and cheaper in real terms, so that the next guy who accesses credit and allows George to find a price to cash in his capital gains, because for you to cash in, it means somebody else is buying at that price, George. You see the point? So if you want to buy, if you want to sell your house at $1 million that you paid $200,000 20 years ago, you need somebody to be able to afford $1 million.
That's right.
And how is he able to do so? Because he can access new credit at cheaper borrowing costs.
So he can have, so he can buy that increased price house with the same income.
Basically, yes. So the point is, in, if you look at house prices in America, in the 90s, the same house which was worth $250,000. It's now worth more than double that amount.
I want to point out, even adjusted for inflation.
Even adjusted for inflation. And so how is that possible? It's because the borrowing costs adjusted for inflation have gone down as well by a mile. So the guy who was borrowing on a 30-year mortgage in the 90s, he was paying in real interest rate terms about 7%. And in 2021, he ended up paying 1%, as we discussed before. Try to annualize the 6% drop of real borrowing costs on a 30-year mortgage. That's a lot of more upfront price you can afford because your real costs of borrowing are much lower. On top of it, real wages also went up a bit, like 0.5%, 1% a year, median over the last 30 years.
Right.
So you have a tiny bit more income, tiny bit, time by time, but now your borrowing costs are so little. And that's why you can afford buying the house. It's more of a wealth illusion rather than-
The point is that it's temporary. That may create more purchasing power, more aggregate demand, but it's temporary. This isn't a structural change to the economy.
No, actually, and my point is that policymakers have an incentive to make this temporarily as long as possible. So it's a preservation of status quo. They want the same model to be applied in a controlled way for the next 10 years too. They have no incentive to make George extremely rich in terms of capital gains. So when they say real rates are going to go to negative 10% or 20%, it's bullocks. There is no policymaker that wants explicitly to be on the very left tail or on the very right tail in terms of scenarios with real rates going to minus 15% or plus 15%. Nobody wants that. If you talk to them like I did, all they want is for cyclical economic growth to be decent. And the only way they can achieve that is by making sure there is a controlled leverage, increasing leverage at lower borrowing costs, marginally every time the new borrower must find it cheaper enough. With this unchanged income, at the end of the day, real wages haven't gone up.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macro economics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
So how do you do that if we're at the zero lower bound and the CPI is at 7.5?
Fantastic question. So I wrote an article, it's called The Macro Endgame on the Macro Compass. It treats exactly this point because Japan shows the way. They've been doing this already for 25 years. They try to make new borrowing available at cheaper rates, real rates. The problem is that once nominal rates go at 0%, then how do you lower real interest rates more and more? I mean, nominals at zero, inflation at 2%, just to say, as an expectation over the very long term, yeah, you're at negative 2%. How do you make negative 10%? It is very difficult. Japan hasn't been successful in doing so because they don't want to go into negative nominal rates. Also, the US is opposed theoretically to negative nominal rates. And so unless inflation expectation go to 3%, 4%, and 5%, you cannot achieve real yields at negative 5%, 6%, or 7%, right? So this game starts to be more difficult to push real yields down, down, and down to make it marginally cheaper for the next borrower. And now, so you start hearing things about CBDC, central bank digital currency. The very reason why the zero lower bound exists in nominal rates, it's not exactly zero. It's a little bit below that. And the example is shown by Switzerland, Europe, Denmark, and all the Western societies which have approached negative nominal rates. So in Europe, the central bank is setting rates at negative 0.5%. And there was a situation in 2019 where we started discussing, can we even cut further? And there were several studies. And I worked in a European bank, a very large one. And also colleagues of ours and other banks had done this reflection. And they thought, okay, if I have all this, you know, liquidity, let's call it liquidity for simplicity, and I'm paying negative 0.5% to park it overnight at the central bank, they are even threatening to make rates even lower than that. So how can I escape this? And the question that floated around was, how expensive is it to stack bills in a vault and pay for insurance costs and basically the space effectively? So how much is it going to cost me per annum to have vaults and insure them? So the nominal lower bound is set effectively by the cost of storage and insurance of physical notes.
Right, that makes sense.
And this cost is around negative 1%, maybe 1.5% maximum a year. So there are some Swiss services that allow you to store and insure a lot of bill notes at about negative 1%. So you understand that central banks will face a problem if they would have to lower nominal interest rates below the threshold. They would encourage a lot more physical notes going around, which will then hamper their transmission mechanism and their monetary policy a lot, to be honest. They don't want that to happen.
Yeah, I just think maybe a more immediate problem, maybe I'm just too US-centric, but actually you're getting some inflation in Europe. I know you're definitely getting it down here in South America and Colombia. I've seen the exact same types of inflation, and everyone's talking about it down here, just like everyone's talking about it in the United States. So I'm trying to put myself in the position of the Fed, and you know, you got, or let's say the politicians, because you got CPI at 7.5. And as you know, and as you were saying before, you know, the politician, their number one priority is not the economy or the people, it's just getting reelected. So, and you know that CPI at 7.5% is political kryptonite. That's the no-go zone for politicians. So, you know, the Fed, I think politically, you know, they have to look like they're doing something, and that doing something could be raising interest rates. At least that's what the curve's telling us, you know, the short end.
Yeah.
The Fed will raise, let's just say, I don't know, I think Goldman says 7 times, let's just go with 3 or 4 here in 2022. So now they're going the opposite direction of the zero bound or negative rates to try to bring down that CPI. You know, even if it is transitory, even if it's temporary, that's what they're going to be doing in the short term. So how do we get from the Fed doing tapering? potentially even raising rates while they're doing QE. You want to talk about a paradox? that's craziness in and of itself. But then maybe going to QT, you know, how do we get from this environment back down to the zero lower bound and potentially negative rates of the CBDC?
Yeah, well, basically the bond market is telling you very, very loudly, with curve inversions going on already now,
yeah.
And I can elaborate on that, that yes, they agree and they believe the Federal Reserve will act, because now we are on the right tail. We are in a situation, as you described, that is kryptonite, politically speaking. You're having inflation at 7.5% and a potential risk of de-anchoring inflation expectations on the upside too, and then starting an inflation wage inflation spiral.
Right.
And there is no policymaker that wants that. Trust me, nobody. So then central banks have to be seen as acting in a pretty strong manner. And so they've been signaling that. And so the bond market is like, okay, if you say so, then I'm gonna believe you, and I'm gonna price you, and even actually I'm gonna chase you to see how committed are you to effectively act. And now I'm looking at my Bloomberg terminal, and there are 7 hikes priced in for 2022. And 2 more, approximately, maybe 1.5 more for 2023. And then the bond market is saying, stop, that is it.
Right.
So basically the terminal rate, how it's defined in this hiking cycle, is about 1.75 to 2%. So bond market is saying, you know what, you can do 2022 very aggressive. We believe you, we're going to do that. We price you to do that. 2023, you can follow up a bit more, and then you're done. Actually, in 2024, the bond market is now pricing the Fed to cut rates, George. There is a 50% chance that the Federal Reserve in 2024 already has to resort back to cutting rates.
But how are you extracting that data from the yield curve? Or are you going to the euro dollar future curve? I know it inverts at 2024, doesn't it?
Correct. So I'm using OIS curves, they're called. I can make it simple. That's basically a swap that tells you what is the expected Fed funds future path to a certain time.
Right.
So the euro dollars are based on LIBOR, and LIBOR also has some interbank risk, some more liquidity driven stuff. OIS is really pure. It's all about federal funds future path. Hmm. And this guy here, if I look at the forward expectations, goes up very sharp in 2022, goes up a bit more in 2023, starts to invert already in 2024. So basically, the bond market is saying, okay, sure, you go, you push on the brakes. We understand you. We price you in. We get it. After 2024, you're done already.
And then you think they're going back down to zero.
So then you know, what's happening is that the growth impulse is obviously coming to a halt. Because in 2020, we went ballistic with all this credit. And then in 2021, we saw this growth. But in 2021 and 2022, where is the credit? Where is the credit being created? When is the last time that the government pushed stimulus through the economy actively?
Right.
Banks are lending, yes, but you know, it's a fraction of what we saw in terms of credit impulse last year. So the economy is cyclically slowing down a bit in terms of impulse. We're still growing. It's not a recession, but we're slowing down. And the Fed is coming in and saying, private sector, I'm going to make the cost of borrowing very, very much more expensive for you guys by raising interest rates, all of a sudden, very quick. And so the private sector will probably say, okay, then I can't borrow anymore because I have to slow down my borrowing activities because it's too expensive now. So this will compound on the slowdown. And the yield curve is telling you exactly that. Actually, yesterday, for the first time, the OIS curve, so the expectation for the federal funds future over time, between 5-year and 30-year, inverted for the first time since 2018. Last time it inverted is July 2018. The right. Stock market basically collapsed 3 months later, and the economy went into quite a slowdown in 2019. You remember
yeah.
that?
And yeah,
so
yeah.
the five-year, 30-year slope just inverted yesterday.
Yeah, I know. I had someone in my Rebel Capitalist Pro group mentioned that the 7 and 10-year inverted as well. He asked me, you know, I said, I don't think that's got the predictive ability of the 2s and 10s, but it means that there's some dark, ominous clouds over the horizon.
George, the 2s and 10s in OIS, again, just the Fed funds expectation, 2-year and 10-year, there is a slope of 26 basis points today. It's flat like a pancake. So whatever curve you look at, in 2024, the Fed is already priced to cut. 5 year versus 30 years, inverted yesterday. 2 year versus 10 year, it's getting there. So the bond market is very loud. Fed, we get you, but you can only do a very short-term hiking cycle. You're going to be very quick. We understand that. But long-term, the structural headwinds that we have because we have excessive unproductive leverage, an aging society, demographics is what it is. The labor force is shrinking. Productivity is stagnant. I'm sorry, but how do you think we can afford to lever up more and more if rates are not zero or lower in real terms?
Yeah, and if we can't lever up, then that's disinflationary.
exactly.
Or yes, at least from a standpoint of economic growth, because I want to differentiate between consumer prices and economic growth, and not just in the United States, but globally, because so many people, you know, hear that kind of us macro nerds talk about inflation and deflation. And they say, well, what are you talking about with disinflation? The price of my groceries are going up, you know, 50% per year. The price of my rent is going up by 20% per year. I know that building costs down here in Colombia and in the United States are just absolutely skyrocketing. So there's a big difference between the prices that you pay daily for the stuff you buy as the average Joe and Jane and economic growth in terms of deflation, inflation, and disinflation. So we're just talking about a retraction in economic growth. My base case for 2022 is we go headline CPI, which I think is completely bogus, but we'll use that as a proxy. I think that's probably worse than M2. but we'll just use that as a proxy. So I think you might go 7.5, you know, you might go up to 8 or something like that. But as the government deficit spending slows down, to your point, they're not getting as many dollars out there. It's going to be lower velocity. So I see kind of, and again, this is my base case, they're only probabilities, no certainties, but I see it maybe going down, you know, 7, 6.5, 6%, something like that. So a bit of disinflation, that would not surprise me. And then as the Fed raises rates, you know, I think at some point they're going to hit a level where the stock market starts to puke that back up. And I think the Fed realizes that the economy is really dependent upon stock, really asset prices in general.
Yes.
And so they say, okay, well, we need to wave the white flag here. We got to do something. And that's probably what the bond market is telling us. Do you have a similar view for 2022 or 2023, or how do you see it playing out?
No, pretty much. So this is, to me, 2018 on steroids.
Right.
So in 2018, we had basically the same thing. The Federal Reserve was hiking rates, promising to do more. You remember when Powell went out and said, we are far away from neutral rates. So which basically meant we're going to keep on hiking here. We're fine. The economy is fine. We're just going to do it. And so they basically continued to do that. But the last economic fiscal stimulus was Trump tax cuts in, what was that, mid of 2017, early 2017. So the economy was already, you're still growing, but coming back to trend growth. It was not a cyclical, very strong growth. And so they kept on hiking into that. And then at some point, the stock market said, I'm sorry, but I can't handle this. The private sector also said, yeah, but you're making borrowing way too expensive for me. And then earnings went down, and then the stock market went down, and then he had to pivot back in 2019. So this time in 2022, it looks to me like 2018 on steroids. The Federal Reserve all of a sudden woke up and said, we need to regain credibility. We need to make sure that inflation expectation don't become de-anchored on the upside, right? So because people start to see 5%, 6%, 7% inflation, they might start expecting inflation down the road to be much higher than 2%. Policymakers don't want that. They don't want that. And also real wages are going down now for a year and a half, George. I mean, like inflation is growing quicker than nominal wages. Right. So the real purchasing power of Americans is getting hit. And they don't want that to be the case for so long. So they act, and so how they act very strong while fiscal deficits are coming back to become fiscal surpluses again on an impulse basis. Yeah, but you know, they can hike rates and they will hike rates, but there will be, you know, a point that according to the bond market is not far away from here, maybe 1.5 to 2%, after which we are done. So it's all about the.
I'm trying to think through politically. And, you know, with the central planners, the financially, the monetary policy. And I'm just, let's just say that we have this 2018 type event, but CPI is at 6%.
Wow.
I'm just, you know what I mean? You I don't have to connect those dots for you. You know, it's just Jerome Powell comes out and says, okay, maybe we better take a more dovish stance. And he gets a call from Biden or the administration and saying, are you out of your mind? You know, you cannot take a dovish stance, because if you do, there is no way I'm going to get reelected with CPI, even at 6%, even if it's down from 7.5. So then, you know, what does Powell do? He says, okay, sure, I won't take a dovish stance, but you realize the stock market's going to go down another 20%, yeah, and that's going to crush the entire economy, and that's going to ensure that you don't get reelected. How does that play out?
So basically, that's quite a pickle if that happens, and then they will be faced with two decisions. Do you want to destroy upfront wealth in terms of paper capital gains, 401ks and the likes, by continuing raising interest rates above neutral levels to really cool all of this down, basically? But that means taking upfront losses, large losses. And the problem is that those assets have gone up in price by a lot because of leverage.
You're talking about positive real rate. I mean, you're talking about taking Fed funds to 6%.
Yeah, well, but if you do that, then obviously what you're doing is taking all the capital gains that have been spurred by leverage at very cheap real rates and reversing the process and saying, okay, guys, all these upfront gains you had, forget about them. We need to cancel them. They need to go down by 30 or 40%.
Well, that's if we take all of that, I mean, that's S&P 1000. S&P 1500, if you took out all of the gains that have been as a result of this credit creation.
You basically have to take you look at earnings. So, I mean, how you price S&P, you look at earnings and forward earning capacity of these companies, and then you attach a valuation to those earnings. Now, instead of valuing stuff with real rates where they are today, so long-term real rates are like negative 1%, more or less, you say, no, guys, it's going to be real rates plus 3%. Mm. So try to make the valuation of the stock market, but discount future cash flows instead with the real rates of minus 1% with plus 3%. And try to see at which valuations do you land. There will be future earnings, obviously. The world doesn't end. But the valuations at which you will be happy to buy these future cash flows are not the same if risk-free real interest rates, I mean, the treasury bond or a Fed funds rate yields you 3%, you're not going to be willing to pay 40 times PE to buy a company, obviously.
Yeah, and Alpha, I'm sorry, I cut you off there. So you were saying that there's two directions they can go. Number one, basically crush capital gains for asset holders. And then number two
is slowly hurting purchasing power. If that is the case and inflation is more sticky, then they might decide not to crash risk assets or assets. So house prices, stock market. House prices, George, so important.
Yeah, right.
They account for 55% of global wealth. 55% of global wealth.
Wow.
So the house market is paramount important, much more even than the stock market, because it's a levered version of the asset side of the balance sheet of the global investor. It's so important. And so they can decide to hurt that, or they can say, no, we're not going to hurt that. But if inflation is stickier, in your example, let's say it stays at 6%, we're not going to raise rates that much. So we're going to hurt the purchasing power then of Americans. We're going to effectively inflict on them real wages that are likely to stay negative still, real short-term rates that are likely to remain negative. So we're going to basically make them die by 1,000 paper cuts, rather than go in there and say, bam, 40% house price decline, 50% house price decline. That's not a nice choice, I have to say. So that is, I guess, the situation that policymakers really do not want to be caught in, where they have to choose between an evil and a lesser evil.
Yeah, yeah. I think, unfortunately, that's going to be the position they will be in, though. We'll have to stay tuned and see what happens.
I mean, the other thing, like on the macro compass in December, I went back and I said, guys, if I am a policymaker now, all I want to do is a gentle tightening exercise. That's what I hope for, because I know I have to tighten. I know I have to be politically credible. I mean, inflation is at 5, 6, 7%. I need to do something here. But I want to do it in a gentle way. I want to make sure that inflation comes down gently, the risk assets, yeah, maybe they reprice a bit, 5%, 10%, but something affordable. We raise a bit interest rates, the private sector cools down a bit, inflation comes down a bit, and then we can restart the engine. That's what they want. Will they be able to achieve it? Well, they're going to give it their best try, but the situation you're depicting, wow, that's a pickle. That's a pickle. So for now, let's see.
Yeah, you know, going back to 2020 and 2021, in terms of our personal liberty and freedom, I was using that quote from Lenin, where he said that there's decades that go by when nothing happens, and there's weeks that go by when decades happen. And what I've started to say on my channels is I see that not only for our personal freedom and liberty now, but I also see that from an economic standpoint in 2022, that we're going to see, it's going to be a very, very interesting, fascinating year from a standpoint of macro.
Yeah. So personally, I also run positions that are visible for everybody. I have nothing to hide. And I give an idea to the people who read the Macro Compass. They understand how am I investing.
Yeah. So I know we're running short on time. Alf, can you tell the viewers and listeners where they can go to find out about what you do in these portfolios and whatnot?
Sure. So I have a free newsletter. It's called the Macro Compass. You just Google it, or you go on Substack, you will find it. And there I publish 4 or 6 articles a month, give you some financial education material. I explain to you how the monetary system works, what the bond market is saying, and how a former professional investor looks at all these dots, macro dots, and tries to connect them. Give you macro insight and some investment ideas as well, where you can see what I am doing, so you can get an idea as well how I manage my risks around my positions. Okay. And as well, you can follow me on Twitter at MacroAlf. If you're looking for another way to follow me.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I sure appreciate your time and a wonderful conversation. It was neat to get to know you, and I really can't wait to do it again.
Thank you, George. I hope I made Lynn happy with the recommendation then.
Oh, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did. All right, have a good one.
Thank you, George. You too.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.